There was a questioner, someone in the break asked me to address something about Christian schools, and I'll address that, and then we'll go into a discussion of more about Christian schools and homeschools and the whys and wherefores and so forth. When you have a large operation, whether it's a big church or a big school, you are going to have a problem with talk. People say, I heard that so-and-so did this and such happened, and pretty soon the word can be out that that let's say some offense was committed at the Christian school, some kid did something. Well, the word about the offense can travel far more rapidly and in a widespread way than the word about what was done about it. Okay, unless the people running the school draw and quarter the kid and hang him out by the highway, the word is not going to travel nearly as far about the discipline as it does about the offense. So people say, did you hear what so-and-so did? And, oh no, I didn't hear it. What'd they do? Well, I don't know. But, you know, I don't know what they're going to do, or I don't know what they did, or so forth. And you can get an impression of a lopsided situation. Now, I sit on the board of a school, and I know the sorts of bizarre things that can get out, that you teach this and you do that, and people talk far more liberally than they have a right to. You've probably heard there should be three keys to the door of your mouth. You know, is it true? Is it kind? Is it necessary? Okay, is it true? Is it kind? Is it necessary? Now, if you've got the, you can say, well, it was true, as far as I know. Okay, and it may have been kind, it may have been well meant, but was it necessary? Were you part of the solution? If you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. If you're not directly involved or directly concerned in this situation, you need to frankly butt out, because you just don't know what's going on, and you're going to muddle things. But on the other side, there's another aspect to this. It is not enough for parents generally, or people interested in the school, or people in the Christian community, to be told to butt out without giving them access in. Right? There are legitimate concerns. Things can come up that should be addressed. Christian school administrators are not omniscient, omnipotent, all-knowing. They don't always do the right thing. And they do need input from people on various things. Let me tell you part of what we've done at Logos. This is not the whole situation, but this has been very helpful. We used to have parent-teacher fellowships, which it was a drag trying to get people to come. You'd have these big PTF meetings, and nobody would come. And you'd have to make these decisions. The PTF would have to make these decisions. And if there were a lot of people, it would have been disastrous, because have you ever, you can't decide whether to have coffee or tea with a group of 40 people. You know, some people, there's always going to be someone who says, well, I think. And you're trying to govern by consensus with a larger group, and if you succeeded in getting a lot of people there, it'd be unwieldy. And if you don't get people there, it's obviously unsuccessful, because the goal of a good school is to get parents involved. Okay? But you want to get them involved constructively, not destructively. Right? And you have to give them constructive channels to move in. If you don't create those channels for them to move in, then they're going to create their own channels, and it's not going to be good. So what we did is we abolished the PTF, the school-wide PTF, and we created a PTF for every class. Because you know what we noticed? We noticed that we had these big PTF meetings that people didn't have the time to come to, but there were all sorts of parents with their ad hoc support groups for teachers and so forth working at the classroom level. So we just made it official. We said, okay, you've got, we created a PTF for every classroom. Okay? Now, what that means is when you have a classroom, when a classroom size is manageable, the problems will come up there, but you're not dealing with 600 people in the school and how many parents and how many supporting churches. You're not dealing with this huge monster. You're dealing with a classroom. It's a manageable thing. Now, each classroom has a PTF representative. What this is Presbyterianism applied to a Christian school. Okay, each classroom elects a, usually it's a mom, like a PTF chairman of the classroom. And that's like the go-between between the teacher and the parents. They're like a room mom or whatever, and they coordinate and facilitate stuff within that classroom. And then each classroom elects a PTF rep. Okay. Well, the representatives go to the PTF council. The PTF council is a meeting of all the PTF reps, first grade, second grade, third grade. These are the parents. The representative from that classroom, the first grade mom, second grade dad, a third grade. So you've got a council of PTF reps. And the PTF, we modified it slightly in this last year, but for the last few years, the PTF reps elect one board member. Okay, now, our setup, the board has got a permanent wing. We didn't want to dilute the vision that we had for the school initially, so we've got certain permanent board members, but we've got now three elected board members. So we don't have all the board members elected because you could rapidly lose your vision for why you started this thing in the first place. If people who don't understand where the school came from, don't understand the history, don't understand why you're doing it, are all elected to the board and they say, well, for example, we have, in our school, we teach Latin starting in third grade. So the kids have third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade, they have Latin. Okay, Dorothy Sayers wrote an article that I commend to you called The Lost Tools of Learning, and she said what we need to do is teach children how to learn, give them the tools of learning so that after they graduate they can learn anything. They know how to learn. And she said we should follow the trivium, the structure of learning in the Middle Ages. The trivium was grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric. And then in the Middle Ages, you studied the trivium, which is grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric. I'll define those in a minute. And then you graduated into the quadrivium, which was specialization in subjects. All right, after you were given the tools of learning, after you learned how to learn, then you went on and majored in something in the quadrivium. Well, she pointed out that the trivium, grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric, corresponded to natural stages that children go through. Okay? And she called them the Paul Parrot stage, the Pert stage, and the Poetic stage. All right, children, little kids, elementary school kids, are Paul Parrots. They love to chant, memorize, tuck those figures away. They don't know what it all means, but they love to do it. It doesn't matter if they're chanting eeny, meeny, miny, mo, or a mo, a ma, sa, mot. They just like the sound of it. Okay? So, Sayers recommended that one of the things you want to do is teach kids the structure of thinking, the structure of language. And you can do that most readily with a declined language. Greek is declined, but it's kind of complex. Latin is much more similar to English in its appearance, and it's a declined language, and I think she's right in that. Well, if you went to Logos School, I taught Latin initially. Back up. When I was going to school, I got a BA in philosophy, and my language was Greek. So then I realized we wanted to teach Latin at Logos, so then I went back to the university to learn Latin so I could teach it. So I was a jump ahead of the kids, and one of those things. Well, then after that, I taught some other adults Latin, or started them, and we hired a woman who had learned Latin and then has studied more at the university, and she's now our full-time Latin instructor, and four-fifths time. And she teaches third, fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. If you went with her into a classroom, third grade, and she could say, all right, now children, oh. And all the kids would chant, O-S-T, mustis int, bo bis bit, bimus bitus bon, bom bas bot, bomus bodus bon, ro ris. These are the verb endings for the various tenses in Latin. And they're clueless. They don't know what it means. Right? They just like the sound of it. And they really do. They love doing it, and they take great pleasure in it, and so forth. But later on, like in fifth and sixth grade, when they start to learn grammar, okay, and they've got, it's all memorized. It's all there. And they say, okay, laudawaram. That's aram, aras, arat. Okay, they can put it all together. But it's all stored away. So when the children love to memorize, have them memorize. What do? We wait till 11th grade when they hate to memorize, and then we make them memorize. We just do it backwards. Anyway, have you ever wondered, when is the ideal time to teach a language? When they're just little bitty, when they're baby. Have 3-year-olds speaking German. You know, Germany is full of 3-year-olds speaking German. China, they're speaking Chinese. Where do they... Now, God has built this capacity, this Paul Parrot capacity, which is necessary in the acquisition of language, early on. And it's much more evident early on than it is later on. But when we teach Latin, when we teach language, we teach it late, not early. Right? And people, you teach Latin in third grade, and people say, well, can kids learn that? Well, every kid comes into school having mastered one language. I don't know what the working English vocabulary of the average kid is coming into first grade, but it's pretty impressive. And why are you going to be limited to one language? Well, anyway, that's the Paul Parrot stage. There's not just, and we do this in all our courses. There's a grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric. There's a grammar of language, but there's also a grammar of history. Okay. The grammar of history would be dates, names. Just you want to get all this stuff in there when their minds are capable of capturing it, seizing on it, and remembering it. So there's a grammar in all subjects. It's really evident in Latin, but there's this grammar early on. So in the early grades, we emphasize memorization, multiplication tables, addition tables, so the kids know it. And that's one of the areas where it's really different. The education I got and the education my kids got. Now, if you said, Doug, what's 9 times 7? You know. Okay, they watched me, I think, up through 5 or 6 or so. But after that, it just sort of dribbled off, and they never made me do it all the way through. I mean, I was just allowed to coast. And my kids, you know, boom, 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 because they learned the grammar of mathematics, the basic structure. They learned their multiplication tables, and they know them cold. That's generally true. The next stage is the PERT stage, which would correspond to the dialectic of the trivium. The PERT stage is when kids, junior high age, kids are argumentative and obnoxious. Right? They love to argue. They love to be contrary. They love to say, well, that's not right, or that's not what Mr. So-and-so said in his other class, and that's, you know, they love to argue. Well, instead of beating them on the head for arguing, Sayer suggests that why don't you teach them how to argue? Right? If they're going to be disputatious, teach them how to dispute. Don't just say, don't do that. Teach them how to do it right. Right? See, grammar, they memorize stuff. And in dialectic, they love to argue. They love to say, what about? What about? What about? And I see this in junior high Bible all the time. The kids are, but what about? And they, instead of saying, this is Bible class, don't ask questions, be pious, all right? What we say is, well, why do you think that? All right, how can you back that up? Draw them out, get them to argue more. And I've seen Christian kids from Christian homes say things in Bible class which run out to their logical conclusion would be blasphemous. Okay, you know, they'll say things like, well, God did this. That's not fair. Okay, now, and so we talk about it. And I know, and I'll get into these debates with the kids in the Bible, and they'll be debating the pagan position, and I'm representing the Christian position, and we'll be debating, and I encourage them to do that. Because I know that when this debate is over, and they go down the street, and they talk with someone else, they're not going to be representing their position anymore, but rather the one they learned from me. That's just how it works. And one of the key disputers, one of the key pert ones, is Becca, my daughter. She loves to dispute and loves to argue, and that's going to pass. She's going to be out of that stage and into the poetic stage, which is when kids get more concerned about their appearance, how they come across. They're concerned about polishing up what they do, they're in the poetic stage, and that's when you should teach them rhetoric. Teach them the substance of the matter, teach them how to dispute, how to reason, and then teach them how to express it well. And then when you've done all that, and they go off to college into the quadrivium, they've learned how to master a subject. So, for example, the senior English class is rhetoric. Okay, the senior English class is rhetoric. They teach, I teach formal logic in 10th grade. So 10th grade is probably right at the beginning of the poetic or end of the pert, somewhere in there. But we teach formal logic in 10th grade and debate in 10th grade. And encourage the disputation and so forth in the other classes earlier on. And then rhetoric, presenting what you believe well and effectively at the end of the process. So that's the quadrivium. That's the trivium. All right. How did I get onto all that? Wendy. That's how I got on. All right. Yeah. Yes. And I did not have this in school growing up, but I had it in my family because we'd sit around the dinner table and debating was an indoor sport. And you'd choose up sides and have at it, and it didn't really matter if you believed what you were saying. It just enabled you to think on your feet, and it was that's how the dinner table conversation was. I remember. It was kind of funny and it was done in fellowship, so it wasn't a quarrel. Many Christians are put off by the term argument. Argument is a chain of reasoning, not a quarrel. Quarreling is sin. Malice is sin. Argument is not a sin. Okay, I believe it's a sin not to argue, at least in your mind. And Christians should argue. Christians must not quarrel. Well, many people have grown up in homes where they've never heard an argument, and all they've heard is quarrels. And sometimes when they hear an argument, they interpret it as a quarrel, or it's just an unusual. I remember one of the first times after I got engaged to Nancy, we went over to my folks' house, and we were just going over for a visit. And two things. We were going over for a visit. And we sat down, and just within a few minutes, my dad and I were going at it over something. And Nancy was like, what has happened? What's going on? But that's the way we grew up. And I believe I got a lot of the benefit of what we're doing at Logos, not from school, but at home. Another time, it was kind of funny because Heather, my sister, was having a birthday party, and they all came over to our house to have this birthday party. So the whole family came over for this birthday party. And Nancy's mother phoned. They live in Coeur d'Alene. And Nancy was talking to her mother, and what's happening at Heather's birthday party? And her mother said something like, what are they doing? And she said, they're all out on the back porch arguing about slavery and the Civil War. Well, it's very good, as it says in Proverbs, as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. And that's what you want to do in school and education, is hone the skills of your kids. Okay, now let me address homeschooling directly. I need to finish up the point I was making. If you have this, quote, Presbyterian system of school government, of the PTF and so forth, you have an established channel, okay, for if you have a concern or a complaint or a gripe or a question, you know who you need to see, right? If you're in the classroom, ask your PTF rep to bring it up at the next PTF council meeting. All right, if you're on the council, ask your board rep to bring it up at the next board meeting. You've got, there's an established place to go, and you know how to express yourself, because if people don't know where to go, they will go to the next person they meet. Right? So not only should you have the structure in place, but input through the structure should be solicited. Right? And if you do that, then I think you would remove a lot of the temptation to gossip and talk. Okay, homeschooling. I don't want what I'm saying here to appear disputatious or anti-homeschooling at all. If Nancy and I had to go to another town or somewhere there wasn't a good Christian school, or there was no Christian school and no time to start one, we would homeschool. I have nothing against homeschool. Fundamentally, I am greatly heartened that parents are taking responsibility for the children. I think it's overall a very good sign. I think Christian schools ought to encourage it. Okay? Christian schools ought to encourage it. Our school is seeking to encourage it. We provide testing services for homeschooling parents. We try and do whatever we can to help homeschooling parents out. We admitted one homeschool child in a special program in the school because the Moscow School District was after them. So we provided them with some legal protection. We want to help homeschoolers wherever we can. Now, obviously, we can't put our degree, our name on a diploma when we have not overseen the education process. We cannot do that. But everything we can do, we want to do for this reason. Unless you are John Stuart Mill's father, that is, an academic superman, you are not going to homeschool through 12th grade. Okay? There are some people who homeschool all the way through. Those people are exceptional. Okay? They are exceptional in their abilities. Here, this is how it works. The average Christian parent who starts thinking about homeschooling thinks about it when their kids are preschool age, and the thing that they are confronted with is teaching literacy, which the average Christian parent can do, on average, far better than the public school system. Right? 700,000 graduates in 88 or 89, 700,000 graduates of United States high schools could not read their own diplomas. Okay? There were 700,000 dropouts and 700,000 people who graduated who couldn't read their diplomas. Okay, so at Logos, we have a higher literacy rate coming out of first grade than the public schools have coming out of 12th grade. We teach phonics, not look-say. That's another, and you don't get me started on that. The method we use to teach reading will teach every child to read unless they are retarded. Unless there's now, let me throw something else in here. By retarded, I mean someone who is obviously and visibly retarded. I do not mean this unaccountable raging epidemic of dyslexia. All dyslexia is a fancy name for the consequences of a botched education. True medical dyslexia causes the person to see everything backwards. Leonardo da Vinci was dyslexic. Oh, he saw everything. It didn't hinder him any either. He had a mirror image of everything. But when you have kids confusing B's and P's, and sometimes it's this way and sometimes it's that way, and it comes and goes, what you have is a child who was not taught his letters. That's what you have. And he was not taught the sound of the letters. For example, if you say, I said not to get me started, but okay, in look say, in phonics, you have taught the child the ch. Ch means ch. The a means has a certain sound, the I has a certain sound, and then certain combinations of letters have certain sounds. So a child who is taught phonics, or what we now have to say intensive phonics, because sort of like saying born again Christian. Well, everybody's a Christian, right? Not a Buddhist. And so you have to say, no, I mean a real Christian. Okay. You say, we teach phonics. Well, a lot of the public schools have gotten on the bandwagon and say, yeah, we have phonics in our instruction, but they don't. You know, they've got a smattering of phonics. We're talking about teaching them phonics. They know every sound that every combination of letters makes, and they know it in first grade, the kindergarten first grade. And that means they can decode from left to right the sound of that word. So a child who has a listening vocabulary that's pretty impressive, has learned how to decode a written word. He's never seen this word written before in his life. But he goes, chair. That's chair. Oh, chair. Okay, and he can read words that he's never seen before. Now, what happens in phonics is where you teach the building blocks of language, and you then teach children how to decode. 80% of public schools use the alternative method, which is called look-say, and the reason for the rampaging illiteracy rate, the reason Johnny can't read, is because of the look-say. What happens is this. There's a picture, there's a this word, and then a picture of a chair. Okay? And the child is not taught what these sounds, what these letters sound like. So he is taught English as though it were Chinese. Chinese, you cannot sound out a Chinese character. So this is what happens. You got the picture of the chair, and you've got this squiggle. And the child says, okay, I know I'm supposed to associate the squiggle with chair. And that's why you'll get kids saying, they'll confronted with pony, they'll say horse. Okay, when they do things like that, and educators are now trying to justify that and saying, well, they got the idea. Right? But what's happening is that the child is learning hieroglyphics. He's not learning a phonetic language. We've turned back 3,000 years of progress, and then we're wondering at, and 80% of our public schools are doing this. And what happens is the bright kids teach themselves phonics. The bright kids say, oh, I remember church. And they put it together. And the bright kids teach themselves phonics. CH means ch. I was never told that. No one ever informed me of that. But that must be what it is. And so these kids learn how to decode on their own. But there are some average students fully capable of learning how to read who are not capable of teaching themselves how to read, and they're left in the dust. They're clueless. And then they get passed into second grade, and then into third grade, and then they can't keep up, and so they send them down for testing. And nobody ever told the kid which way to decode the squiggle, not top to bottom, left to right, right to left, which way do you go? And that's why you get kids. When you show them this, they see this. They're trying to remember the squiggle as a whole. They've not been taught to take it apart. Well, this is the reason for illiteracy in America. This is why. There's no other reason. Why Johnny Can't Read by Rudolf Flesch. Wrote it 20 years ago, and he wrote another book called Why Johnny Still Can't Read. And the reform in the public schools has been just astonishingly slow. It has been demonstrated time and time and time again that phonics produces literacy in 100% of the ordinary kids, average kids that come in. There's a lot of reasons. I'd say number money in textbooks, positions, admissions of failure, pride. Some people, some conspiracy buffs, believe they're doing it on purpose. They want kids to be socially malleable. And you teach them how to read, and they go off in the corner with a book and learn anything they want to.
Some of the teachers now teaching them what type of things they must have themselves, and they themselves don't
know. Right. Yeah. Teachers don't know how to teach phonics. It's a major problem. But anyway, this is one of those things. Remember when I said parents who have their kids in public schools need to be on top of it? If you've got your child in public school, or you know anybody who's got a child going into first grade in public schools, they had better get down there and find out what the curriculum is, because your child has a 20% chance of coming out illiterate of the whole system, of 12 years. So are you willing to place that kind of bet? The averages, the statistics are not good. So parents, godly parents who are on top of it, need to say, okay, is this phonics? Why not?
Are you saying that there are no qualified learning disabilities?
Oh, sure there are. Yeah, there are real learning disabilities, but they're not learning disabilities by the truckload. What we have by the truckload are teaching disabilities. Okay, yeah, there are special students that need to be helped in a special way, but what we have done is made an industry out of our own failures. We have failed to teach ordinary kids to read in an ordinary way, a way that we knew how to teach literacy for 3,000 years. There's no big mystery. It's very simple. It's very straightforward. We've been doing it for thousands of years. And then we started graduating people who wanted to treat kids as experimental guinea pigs rather than as, you know, carrying on the tradition of teaching literacy. So, yeah, there are learning disabilities, but not lots and lots and lots and lots of them. So be careful. You know, I have little warning lights when people say, well, my kid's a strong-willed child. Well, all children are strong-willed children. People say, we have some people in the school, an eighth grade boy, he's got reading problems. He learned to read in public school before he came as well as he does read. He, I think, got this treatment, and he's still struggling, eighth grade, and his mom is just absolutely convinced that he has dyslexia, and he doesn't. It's just, it's that simple. He doesn't. Okay, then to...
What to deal with erasing.
What they've...
Yes, the input.
And teach him how to read the right way. Just teach him phonics. And this boy and another boy we did put in a special class, and it was there was improvement. So...
That's another thing. Often though, once a child has learned this way of reading, it's not real easy for them to learn phonics as if they have learned it right the first time.
Right. It's
an ordeal to go through with them.
Okay, let me give you an example. I told you the multiplication tables. I don't know how many of you learned to read with Dick and Jane. That's the primer that I learned to read with. Dick and Jane was look-say, not phonics. Okay? And I still, just like I don't know 9 times 7, I still don't know the sound of my vowels. I can't tell the difference between a long A and a short A. I don't know which one's which. I know that there's such a thing. All right? And I'm one of the kids, I believe, that taught himself phonics. Now, I've had Latin, I've had Greek, and I've had 2 years of Spanish, and I don't know the sound of my vowels. All right? So there's a real, and my kids do. Right? They are taught and repeated in the grammar stage over and over and over again. This is the sound that this makes. This is the sound that this makes. And this is the sound that this makes. So you're exactly right. And I'm an example of that. I can go back and look it up in the dictionary and say, okay, long A is...
What is A?
A.
And also in your dictionary, there is a P, pronunciation guide, which explains your configuration.
But I've got these Teflon brains on this. If I'd been taught this in first grade, I think it would have stuck. A lot of things did stick. But I've looked it up before and say, okay, I know one of them is apple. I know one of them is the apple sound. Which one is which? Short A, thank you. All right, we'll see here. See before you a train wreck. And that, now, so, and I want to go back and provide for my children something that I did not get. And this is an issue that the public schools are failing, and they're failing wholesale in a major way. And it's a national scandal that we put up with it. Last thing, I want to touch on the problem with homeschooling and why should Christian schools encourage homeschoolers? I'm college educated, as is my wife, and we are both teaching in a Christian school, and we have 3 children, 8th grade, 6th grade, and 4th grade. If we had to supply our children with a homeschool education right now at the level they are currently being educated, we could not do it. Okay, we're extremely committed to their education, we're extremely involved in it, and we would be willing to do what we could. But if we moved to another city, there was no Christian school, we would homeschool, but there would be a dip in the quality of education that they were getting. Because parents who are teaching their child literacy can do a better job than the public schools, rather handily, because teaching literacy is a pretty common sense kind of thing. It's not complex, and it can be, there are good materials out for homeschoolers on how to teach phonics and how to teach your child to read. And the average Christian parent can do an outstanding job of imparting literacy to their child and basic mathematics, addition and multiplication, and you know, they can work with these things. The problem hits when you, I think around third and fourth grade is when the problem hits. And this is where division of labor becomes a real help. It's one thing to have a baby and to teach a five-year-old how to read. It's a completely different ball game when you are teaching an eighth grader history, math, science, foreign language, and so forth, and you're teaching a sixth grader history, math, science, so forth, and dad's at work all day. Okay, and on whom does the burden fall? Mom. Now she's juggling all these things, and she starts to get in over her head, and she starts to say, now I believe most parents, if they persevere past that point, are going to start imparting a slipshod education. Right, they're going to be overwhelmed, and if they don't come to grips with what's going on, and if they're not part of a good homeschool association where they can compare where they ought to be, they're just off doing their own thing. They don't know. The Bible says those who compare themselves with themselves are not wise. Right, so you have to have some kind of objective measurement. Now this means that I believe a lot of homeschooling parents are going to hit what the Moors call homeschool burnout. And I think this is what it is. It's part of what causes it. Things, you start to get into the deeper and deeper water. And if you're exceptional parents, both PhDs in all sorts of fields, and you've got it covered, yeah, you can do it. If Christian schools have viewed homeschoolers as competition rather than preparation, then Christian schools are cutting their own throat. I as a Christian school board member, I say the more people who react to the state schools, the better. If General Motors wanted to start a day school, a private school, I'm all for it. The more people we can get out of the public schools, the better. And we'll just keep doing a good job, and we will keep the lines of communication open with as many homeschoolers, for example, as we can, so that when they hit this crisis point in fourth grade, dovetailing with the curriculum that we've got is going to be a relatively simple thing for them to do, and they're not going to be mad at us because we've been treating them as the competition. The more parents out there who are taking their responsibilities as parents seriously, the better it is for Christian schools, the better it is for a good Christian school. Even if you don't get their business in the first 2 years, you're going to get their business overwhelmingly later on. So when I said in our church is affiliated with this school, and 25% of the people in the church don't have their kids in it. Okay, that's fine with me. I think it's wonderful. I believe 95% of them will have their children in the Christian school later on in the upper grades. They don't have them now. But if we handled the job badly, if we regarded them as a threat or didn't want anything to do with them, didn't tell them anything, if we botched it, what's going to happen is when they hit that crisis point in the third and fourth grade, they're going to give up the fight entirely, and their kids are going to go into the public school, which is a tragedy, or they're going to form a homeschool co-op, and they're going to form another Christian school that is responsive to their concerns, and that is competition for your Christian school. So I think it's very important for homeschoolers to realize their limitations. Now, the limitation has to do with your expertise in science or your expertise in calculus or your expertise. That's where the limitation is. There is no limitation on parental responsibility on how your child is taught calculus and whether it's by a Christian and whether the Christian is behaving in a godly manner and whether what they're teaching is consistent with what the Bible says. The parent must know that. And their child should be in a Christian school where they can have their hand on the pulse and know that that's what's going on through established channels, through the right channels. Any questions?
I've noticed that when we were in Southern California, all the homeschoolers, as their kids got older, would do an apprentice type thing where they would hire an individual to teach these group of children.
Right.
Okay, but that's how they work, like handling a lot.
Right. What that is an alternative school. That's, yeah, it's a much more informal school, but that's how they handled it. So you have to go to some form of division of labor. If you have a band, a musical band with a music teacher for a homeschool association, that's a rudimentary school. May not have a facility, but it's a school. And that's a fine way to handle it. Yeah, that is, if you can handle it that way, I think it's great. If the parents acknowledge their limitations. And we've seen homeschool parents do a great job, and we've seen some problems. In second grade last year, there was a little kid from the public schools who was just really struggling, and a homeschool kid who'd come in who was just really struggling. And some homeschool parents are unfortunately kind of faddish. Well, I don't believe in teaching him to read until he's 8 or 9 or until he's ready for it. Boys particularly are intellectually lazy, and they're not going to be ready for it for a long time. If you have a biblical worldview, you realize that work is cursed, and the Lord has cursed the ground, and you have to learn to make your living by the sweat of your brow. It's not fun initially. You can learn to rejoice in it if you've learned discipline, but if you just sort of, oh, I'll work when I feel like it, you're not going to feel like it that much, and it'll be a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding the hands to rest, and you're poor. Right? So with children, and this is particularly true of boys, if they're intelligent. If you have an intelligent boy, he will figure out, probably in the upper elementary grades and maybe earlier, that, hey, I don't have to study, and I can pass, the roof doesn't fall in, and I'll coast. And that's what I did. I'm ashamed to say it, but I coasted. I don't remember in high school ever studying, ever. You know, I just coasted. I was not truant or anything. I was smart enough to go to the class and have an idea of what was going on. So I passed and I got through and so forth. But I was coasting. And my son, Nathan, last year in fifth grade, discovered that was his year to try and figure this out. I can coast. I can play as much as I want. I go to class and I'm smart enough to pass. And we told him that if you were dumb, we would let you do that. We would let you just pass if you were dumb, but you're not. Right? If you can get A's, you will get A's. If you can't get A's, we love you and C's are great. Right? If you're trying as hard as you can, we love you just the way you are. But if you're goofing off, that's a sin. Okay, and we clobbered him all year. Just we wrote his case. And this last year in sixth grade, there's been a real turnaround and he is now self-disciplined. But if we hadn't ridden him all year as parents, in fifth grade, he would still be coasting, and he would coast into seventh grade and coast into eighth grade, and then he would just graduate and dink around until life caught up with him and he said, oh no, whatever, now I have to start studying on my own. Yeah.
Do you have anybody that homeschools where some of the kids are homeschooled and not all of the kids are homeschooled, and how does that work? Is there a problem within the family, problem getting it done?
No, we have, there is a one couple in particular that I'm thinking of in our church, where the older kids are in the school and they're planning on homeschooling. They just had a baby and they're planning on homeschooling her. And sometimes homeschooling is necessary for financial reasons. You know, even though Christian schools are half the price of public schools, they still cost money. And some parents who take the responsibility seriously should look at homeschooling for the first couple of years. But I can say, and I can't promise anything about all Christian schools, but I can say that in our school, if a parent came to us and said, I am dedicated to Christian education, I don't have a lot of money, can we work something out? Okay, now we can't afford to just say, sure, come. We can't afford to do that. But we can afford to work something out. What do I mean by that? Well, the reason I teach logic and debate in two Bible classes is a tuition swap for my kids. That's why I'm doing it. I'm providing them a service, and my kids get to go in exchange for my teaching. We have moms who drive our school buses. We have if someone comes to us and says we are dedicated, we don't have a lot of money, what can we do? There are all sorts of things that Christian schools spend money on that they that they could be creative and work with parents on. But I don't see any problem with homeschooling some and not others. I don't. It would just be in that family. You'd start going to school, the regular school in third grade, or the reverse. The older kids being homeschooled. Okay. I would say that you'd probably have a special case if you wanted to do that, because it's at the older grades that homeschooling is the most difficult to do. But that would depend on the expertise of the parents. You know, if the students were studying stuff that the parents knew how to impart and knew how to do, it might cause a problem with the kids if you did it in reverse.
A friend of my daughter's, and she's a freshman in college, this girl was homeschooled through her junior year in high school, and her brothers and sisters are all younger. And I asked her, you know, how did your mother handle, you know, all these ages? And she said, well, by the time she got to be a certain age, she was pretty well teaching herself.
Right.
And they must have received a curriculum, and she knew what was required, and she knew what the schedule was, and she just kind of
right.
did her own thing. And
I believe that that can be done successfully. But even there, the parent has to be the child has to be self-disciplined, and the parent has to be really disciplined and see to it that the child does it.
But the other comment, and she even said this about herself, and I've talked only very briefly with her, my daughter feels that she is very independent. How is she socially? Because she only went into public school
right.
as a senior. She didn't have the interaction all through school. And my daughter says, well, she's very independent. She doesn't really need me as a friend. And her own comment about herself is, she says, I feel sometimes I'm too independent. I don't need other people.
Right.
And I thought that was, I would have thought maybe the reverse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She might need people because she hadn't had a lot of interaction.
Right.
You know, I've heard that a lot about homeschooling children, but yet I am more concerned about my children standing their ground than being real sociable with everybody.
The social argument, I believe, goes back to John Dewey. And John Dewey said, and this is true about literacy, John Dewey said that he thought that socializing was more important than learning how to read. Okay, the progressive public educators want to cultivate a herd mentality. Okay, they want man to be part of the hive. They want part of the collective, and what you could call it a daycare kid. You know, we've starting them really early. Let's put them in the herd and teach them to groupthink, and so consequently. People have said, well, a high priority of education is socialization skills. It is not. Socialization skills are important. I mean, it's something that you parents should be concerned about. How do my kids socialize with other children? That's a consideration for parents. It is not an educational priority. Education is to teach them how to cipher and read and think, and that's what the education is supposed to deliver. And a homeschooling parent can solve the socialization problem very simply by seeing to it that other kids come over and play regularly. Or sports or some parks and rec program. So I think the socialization problem is a problem, but it's not an education problem. And it can be solved by a homeschooling parent pretty simply. So I don't buy the socialization argument.
My own feeling, meeting her, I thought she was so at ease and very easy to talk to, more than your typical
mm-hmm.
So that maybe she was actually more sociable
than
the normal
right. kid. Right. See, and that is an advantage, and this is something that we want to be aware of in our school, is if you put a bunch of third graders together, you're going to perpetuate a third grade mentality. Okay? Even if you don't want to cultivate a herd mentality, you're going to get one sort of naturally, which in a good Christian school, it will be combated. The way we combat it is we involve the older kids with the younger kids. We don't just have the kids of one age totally isolated from, they're with the kids of different ages on the playground, and they're and we involve the older kids with the younger kids as part of the program. So it's we I think have addressed that, but you don't want, and you can see this. Why did babies talk baby talk? Adults teach them how. Now, if you talk to your kid like an adult, you know, he'll grow up speaking. My nephew Davis is in second grade, and he calls my brother Evan father. You know, children speak the way we teach them to speak, and if you speak to them requiring them to be mature and responsible in their dealings, they will grow up and be mature in their dealings. But if we perpetuate immaturity, we can say, well, you're expected to be immature all the way through high school. That's what you're going to get. And that has ramifications on youth group programs, but we won't go into that.
Just a quick one, I think.
Let's pray. Father, we thank you very much for what you've given to us. We thank you for our children, and I pray that we would take seriously your charge to us to bring them up in the Lord. In Jesus' name, amen.